Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. Hey, everybody. I finished this most incredible book today. I'll tell you, Foo, it's funny. The cover is really beautiful, but there were a few of us who picked up the book and were trying to read it left to right. So it's called Jesus of the East, Reclaiming the Gospel for the Wounded. But the way it's printed, some of us were like, wait a minute, Joe F. Haas? Yeah. So anyway, but it's gorgeous and amazing. And it is not a new release, but I would say one that is, as the words we use in pre-recording, just the information in this is perennial. So I'm really appreciative for your work, for you writing it and sharing it with me. And thanks for coming on today to talk about it.
Thank you, Alexis. I appreciate the opportunity.
So I was really intrigued by the title, Jesus of the East, but also this subtitle, Reclaiming the Gospel for the Wounded. And I want to start by saying I don't know how it could be a surprise with the title, but I was pleasantly surprised when I dug into the book and was reminded of some of the traditions from Eastern Christianity that I had honestly sometimes just kind of blown through in some of my church history classes, global tradition classes. And I had this like warm feeling inside, and I was like, oh yes, I remember reading about this, you know, this, you know, the differences in sin concepts and incarnation, you know, and some of the, and I had this just warm feeling kind of bubble up all over again. And I was like, yeah, I wanted to spend more time there. And thanks to your book and this conversation, I get to spend a bit more time there. So I would love, you know, for that to be the place where we started, but I would also love to get some of your background and, you know, how this, not just conceptual Jesus of the East, but how this real incarnational Jesus of the East became someone who really interested you, someone that you want to follow and love and imitate and how this Jesus of the East has captivated you.
Yeah. I love the way in which you framed those questions. So I, some time ago had started my PhD work and was interested in this driving atonement theories. And I had taught several classes in Christian history, Christian doctrine, the history of Christian doctrine, and came across this concept that was just, I thought, really important about how the idea of redemption should be described, but it's not a necessity. And so what does it mean? It's not a necessity. So it questions whether or not Christ had to die. And if that's a possible question, you know, a theologian's question, then that sort of takes apart all these things that we think of when we talk about redemption and Jesus dying on the cross for our sins and things of that nature. So it started me on this long journey of trying to figure out. Then I like you, I had studied these theories of atonement in seminary and understood them, but did not grasp diverse nuances and what each theologian who has set down those theories were trying, what they were trying to convey, and then other ways to look at what Jesus actually did. So I wrestled a long time with this and came upon, across the work of a Korean American theologian. He's Methodist, Andrew Sun Park, and his work on what he calls the Triune Atonement. And then I came across the work of Canadian theologian Bradley Jerzyk, and I found him out through a mutual friend who is a Old Testament theologian, who wrote this wonderful article about Isaiah and the suffering servant. And so in my conversation with Jerzyk, I discovered how similar what is called Minjong, or the people's theology, that centered around the healing of those wounded by oppression, and what the early Eastern fathers were doing in their work, and then came to put those together, and it's like, this is something fantastic that I really needed to explore. And so 90,000 words later, no, I did it in my dissertation, 6 years and 90,000 words later. And then from that, of course, we all know that dissertations are written for five people on this planet. I had to distill maybe, I would say, 10% of what was good from my work into Jesus of the East. And so that's how the journey began. It was one of just really tough work trying to get a sense of what theologians were doing in history, the earliest ones, Irenaeus of Lyons, and taking that and bringing it to contemporary theology, and doing something good with it. And so basically, the premise of Jesus of the East is that, and the thing is, but Jesus of the East should not be controversial, because Jesus came from a Near Eastern country, whose culture is very much different than ours. And also, the earliest theologians were these Eastern fathers doing work trying to explain their experience of God in this world, given Jesus's life. And so it should not be controversial, but it is, because what we have inherited, especially here in the US, is a Jesus of the West, one that's much different, shaped by a lot of other factors. And so yeah, that's sort of the origin of the book.
Yeah, the Western Jesus, and I think it's clear from the context in which you're speaking, but I want to say for me, because even as I was writing some of my notes, when we're talking about Jesus of Western Christianity and Jesus of Eastern Christianity, historically, folks can look this up and read. I mean, they wouldn't be able to read all of the volumes written on this, but there's just not enough time. But historically, we're talking way, way back there. There were splits, and there were the tradition that we have been raised in without even really knowing it has come from a Western Christianity split. So when I'm saying Western and you're saying Western, we're not saying things that originated now, like, you know, the US and Western Europe, kind of as we think of this, we're talking about this like way back in, you know, in like third century time and around this time, and then the East, which survives in some forms in some traditions like Eastern Orthodoxy and things like that. And so there is so that's kind of just for clarity what we're talking about when we're talking about is Western Christianity and Eastern Christianity, Western Jesus and Eastern Jesus. But there are some theological concepts that were at the centers of some of these schisms that have continued to shape the traditions. And one of them I would love for you to elaborate on is this concept that we have grown up as a given. I would say speak for myself, but most of us, and I think in American evangelicalism at least, and Catholicism to that matter, of original sin. And we think about this in a certain way, and Eastern traditions think about this in a very different way, which shapes how we think about Jesus, how we think about his life here, how we think about the incarnation. It just shapes the way, even how we think about ourselves and our relationship to God. So can you give us maybe some Cliff's Notes on how the Eastern tradition would even frame that concept, or even if they would frame that concept?
Yeah, so the concept of original sin as we know it today, like you said, in the Roman Catholic Church, and then even in sort of regular church parlance, and even among different denominations, is about the idea that sin originated from our primeval ancestors, right? Adam and Eve disobey God. They sin against God. They were cursed. That curse is death. And we inherit that curse by being born. So our guilt is traced back to Adam and Eve. And so we are all by nature sinners because of that original sin. So that's usually the framing of that. And going back to this idea of Western Church, that had became a major staple of the Western Church, the Roman Church, okay, during the time of Constantine. We have a major church theologian, Augustine of Hippo, who brought that to the center stage, and the church adopted it as the main way in which they would talk about the reason why Jesus died on the cross was to cleanse us from that original sin. Okay. And for the Roman Catholic Church, the only way in which we were cleansed from it is literally through baptism. Now, so that's why the babies are baptized, to rid of that original sin. And so that was God's grace. Okay, the sacrament is the visible display of that invisible grace given to people. Okay. And so so that's the story of original sin. Well, and during that time, in the Roman world, when the church councils met, there was also the Eastern Church. And the Eastern Church, by and large, did not have the same theories about original sin. They had a story of sin, but it didn't go back to Adam. Sin was in the world, and we It's like radiation, okay? Like nuclear waste, okay? It's in the world and it taints our life, okay? And we can fall into sin, and those are choices that we make. And baptism served a very different thing as a way to enter into a relationship with Christ's body. But it was not to wash away any kind of original sin. So their reading of Adam Eve was not that Adam and Eve brought sin to the world, but instead shame, which is a very Eastern concept. Okay. If you want to talk about shame, I'm from a Asian culture. I could talk about growing up in shame all day long. Okay. But this idea of guilt is not there. So what, and you read the story of Genesis, and one way to read it is that why did Adam hide from God? Well, he was ashamed that he was naked. Okay, he saw that at one time he was intimate with God, right? Nakedness is a metaphor for intimacy, right? And he and Eve, humanity, we were all intimate with God. And now, because of the things we did, we were no longer intimate with God. We saw our shame and we hid from God, but God always would return to us to ask if we would take walks with God. That's a beautiful story and way to put it. Shame came into the world, and that's what we have to deal with. Okay, this pull of shame, but as it was never guilt. It was never about guilt. And in a lot of ways, shame could be a good thing because shame, we could always, if we're ashamed of something that we did, improve, right? We could always make changes. Whereas guilt, we're just declared guilty or not, right? And that's almost impossible to fix, right? So the story of the Western Church is one of this original sin that we are somehow all sinners going back to Adam, whether Adam's seed or some spiritual inheritance of sin. But the problem with that, and the real problem is that is it doesn't separate the sinner from the sin against. Okay, so what I mean is, let's say at any given church and any on any given Sunday, we go to church, and at the end, whether it be before we take communion or at the end of a church service, the pastor, priest would invite people up, right? And we would get a forgiveness of sins in the Episcopal Church. In the Episcopal Church, there's the confession of sin, there's an absolution of sin. Other churches, there might be an altar call, right, to pray the sinner's prayer. But ultimately, the person who is a sinner gets forgiven of sin, right? There's something there for them, right? But if we talk about the sinner, right? Let's say I'm the sinner. I did something bad. I need forgiveness, okay? The pastor, she prays for me. I'm forgiven. Okay, thank God. No more sin. Okay. But that assumes that I sinned against someone, correct? So here I am. I'm forgiven. That's great for me. But what about the person I sinned against? What do they get? Nada, right? So this is the framework from which I'm operating. Jesus, in his time, he ministered to those who were sinned against, those who were wounded by the political and religious structures. Okay, so the people who he was with, they were often called what? Sinners. Okay, were they really sinners? Did they actually did anything wrong? Well, the word sinners sometimes apply to shepherds. Okay, why were shepherds sinners? I ask my students this. Okay, if you're a shepherd, you have sheep, and it was the Sabbath, right? The time of rest. You go to synagogue, you study the Torah. That's great. Now, if you're a shepherd and it's Friday evening, you're getting ready for Sabbath, you can leave your sheep under the tree. You're going to walk off and go to synagogue. No, you can't do that. Okay. It's a full-time job. So, because the shepherds could not keep to those religious practices, they were called sinners by the religious people. Okay. So that was a name given to them. Okay. And when Jesus is accused of eating and drinking with the sinners, these were people who the religious elites, the Pharisees, the scribes would say these are the unholy people. We're holy by nature of what we do. They're unholy. But were they actually sinners? What sin did they really commit? And so Jesus spent his life in ministry to these people who were spiritually wounded by being oppressed in that way, religiously oppressed, but also people who were wounded physically, people who had ailments, sick, the lame, the lepers. They were considered sinners because of this idea that if you were lame or blind or whatever, there must be something that you did wrong and God cursed you. Therefore, by nature, you're a sinner. Okay. And so Jesus was like, whose sin was this? So that this man was born blind, right? They had this reverse causal idea, okay, that goes back to the book of Deuteronomy, right? If you are blessed, okay, that means you've done well. If you're cursed, you've done wrong. So what I'm trying to do is go back and just basically ask a question. Okay, if Christianity is about Jesus dying on the cross, forgiving our sins, erasing that, no more sin, right? Alexis, we look around, no more sin, nowhere. Okay, if that was really true, then why didn't it work? Okay, but we've told ourselves the story over and over again. And so I'm trying to say, okay, maybe, just maybe, we got this a little bit messed up, and I'm trying to find another way forward.
Well, I mean, I think this, I like the way that you kind of, helped us envision this, like, because we've been taught to think about ourselves as sinners. And so when we can receive this blessing, this prayer, this assurance that now we have been forgiven. But yes, then what about the people who have been wounded, who have been harmed? What about us when we've been harmed by someone else's sin? And so this is one question that I kind of want to leave hanging a little bit, because we do talk quite a bit about justice and justice related things on this podcast. So I want to leave that hanging in the air for me and for folks right now. And I want to ask another related question, because in this Western Christianity that you described, and we're all born sinners because of Adam and Eve, and we have this guilt now if we take this Western, tradition in it, and it looks very different than the shame from the Eastern tradition. But one of the things that we've also been discipled under this theology is that God is very angry about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is an atonement theory that is quite popular. We weren't taught it as I wasn't taught it as an atonement theory. I was taught it as the atonement theory, which is a penal substitution atonement.
The truth.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Which basically in a kind of blunt nutshell, basically sounds a little bit like this. Because of our sin that we have inherited, God is very angry with the world. He's very angry with people. And I mean, this sounds crazy when I'm saying it very bluntly like this. To me, I say it now because it just sounds very harsh, but God was very angry, and his wrath had to be poured out on something. He had to do something about it. And so he took it out on Jesus. He sacrificed Jesus. Jesus willingly went, but he was sacrificed. And now his wrath is satisfied. He doesn't have to do anything to humans. If, and there's a big if, right? They receive this this idea, this belief. They come into this belief that that this happened. They believe on Jesus, is how I was, raised to say it. And then now the wrath, this is kind of another tricky part. The wrath will eternally be poured out on someone, for folks who don't subscribe to this belief, but for everyone else, it isn't. And one of the things that caught my attention when I was reading through your book was just, I'm saying, let's just step back for a second. Let's just pretend that this was the first time I've ever heard this. It's not. I'm in my 40s and I was raised in the Bible Belt, buckle of the Bible Belt. So this is not the first time I've heard this, but I just, sit back and say, what if this is the first time I've heard this? And what if this was a story someone was telling me about their father, or, their uncle, or a leader in their community, or, someone like this? I would have a perspective of this person that was not, that this person is not, that's not loving. This is not a kind thing to do. This is not a caring, situation. And that's just me just kind of thinking, kind of thinking through it. But I had to pause and say, is this the only way to think about it? I mean, I've been introduced to some other theories in the last several years that I've got to be truthful, I like better than this one, but this is still the predominant, and especially in American evangelicalism, this is still the predominant atonement theory. We can call it, even atonement, as we chatted about pre-record, even that word is tricky because it's not found anywhere biblically, this word. So we're working from some things that, people have found in the scriptures of the centuries, but I'm bringing this up for a couple of reasons. A, because it's very formative. So it shapes how we think about ourselves as people. It frames how we think about God as creator and lover of our souls. It feels like a juxtaposition there. But it also has shaped, and we may not completely get there, but I'm gonna throw this out and ask people, skip to the last chapter in the book if you can, because this is where, where you really talk about a lot of the implications systemically. But this also really shapes the systems that we have built that are based on this just these justice systems that say like retributive is the answer. We have to do, you know, something. I live in Texas, right? You and I both live in Texas. So thinking about the death penalty, right? Violence is the answer for violence. Yep. You know, things like this. So it's formative in a lot of ways, because and I want you to talk about this, but I'm gonna throw this out there. When we subscribe to this kind of theory and we believe this about God, it stamps it, my words, like it gives it some kind of stamp of approval, right? That says violence is okay. This is the way that the world has been saved, is through God co-signing or ordaining or demanding some sort of act of violence, and not just an act of violence, but an act of violence against his own person, his own son, however we view this, against someone who showed up as human. So anyway, I'm going to step back for a second and let you explain, correct, edit, and further that topic for us.
No, you're... Yeah, I think you got it spot on, you know, and I would even add God's violence towards God's self, right? Yes. So what do we know as a penal substitutionary view of atonement is not very old, you know, historically, and this comes to
by way of John Calvin, and so 16th century, about which he kind of pilfered Anselm's theory, so early medieval theory, 11th century. But it doesn't, like, when we talk about like early Christianity, Irenaeus, you know, we're talking, you know, close to apostolic age, where, no, these were the first disciples, you know. And so this idea about God having to punish because of God's anger, now is just very problematic. Some theologians, let's say like John Piper, would say something like, well, that's God's loving way. We punish our children because we love them, okay? And I say, okay, sure, we might do that, but how about this? The punishment that we give to our children is not in violence, okay, or should not be in violence. Violence and love are mutually exclusive, okay. And the reason why I'm adamant to say this is that just in that idea of, or the word violence, to violate, okay? If we are children of God, those made by God, it very much bothers me that God would violate God's creation in that way. And Jesus is described as the pinnacle of God's creation, or the foundation of God's creation, however you want to describe Jesus. And so saying that God did this, okay, and that's justification for what we can do. If God did it, then why not? Why can't we do this? Saying that, it just is very problematic. You know, God had, and also saying God had to do this. This is the only way in which it can happen. Okay, so God, who, as Christians describe, is an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-loving God, is bound to one way to solve a problem. Yeah, that, to me, again, ridiculous. I it's hard for me to comprehend that that's how God's justice would work, right? Because in no world can we say that, I use this illustration to my students. Okay, so Lena, she got an A on her paper. It was perfect paper. I read it today. So if you're listening, Lena, that's a 100. But another person, he just fouled it up. But I said, I could take your paper, Lena, and give him the grade, and punish you, give you an F. That's my justice. In no world would that be called justice. But Christians have stamped it as something just, and therefore justified the other things we do, which are unjust. And so I think you have a spot on, and those are the implications, right? We have in our Western society justified the use of violence, because one, we think it's redemptive somehow, right? That if we meet violence with violence, something good can come out of it, okay? Or that happened and it was bad, and God ordained it because it was violent. God will use that. One illustration I had in my book, God caused the Vietnam War, so I could come here to the States and be a Christian. Okay, that's how God uses violence. Two, violence is used to say that these are the ways in which we could solve things in our world. So that our litmus test for success in life is violence. Okay, and that might seem extreme, but think of the language in which we use. Okay, and we teach our young people this all the time. Okay, so when we want to say you're gonna do great on a test, we say stuff like you killed it, you nailed it. Okay, when a young man, is successful in engaging with a young woman romantically, you bagged her, you nailed her. Okay. When I'm typing email to you, Alexis, I can shoot you an email. I can take a stab at this. If we just sit and think about how we talk about, and Ocean Vuong, has talked about this more than I have, but if we look at how we talk about success in life, the things we achieve, accomplishments, ways in which we solve problems, and violence, the language of violence, there are so many intersections of that. And so we have it in our psychological memories and histories in the West to describe what we do on a daily basis as being violent. So that comes around to how we perceive God as being one who must do this in order to get what God wants in the world.
Yeah, I want to thank you for that. As we I want to say kind of start wrapping up. We're gonna start landing the plane. I do want to get to this kind of last chapter where you talk about the implications a bit and maybe moving forward in different ways. I want to use an example that really struck me. And that was this example of an African tribe. And in this tribe, they have a tradition that when someone does something, I think the words you use are someone does something irresponsible or unjust, something like that, that this person gets kind of set in the middle of a circle, and people come around him or her and recall individually, recall the good things that this person has done and the strengths, the character strengths of this person. And so I'm not using this example, nor do I think you are, to say accountability is not important or anything like that. But I would say when I read that, what I thought was, isn't that just like God? To remind us of, you know, in times of trouble, in times of foolishness, in times of irresponsibility that we all face, to remind us of who we are, you know, the good things that we exhibit, how he created us. And you know, just thinking about, now, maybe this is because if I go real old school evangelical, I'll say way back when I took my test, it came up as words of affirmation as a love language for me. So this is a 25-year-old test or something. But, you know, so maybe it hit me in a particular way because of that. But I'm just thinking, what is more motivational for us to move forward in love, for us to move forward in peace, for us to move forward in responsibility, for us to move forward in justice, to be reminded of who we really are, and not of our foolish decisions? And, you know, when we, you know, I think of, there's a verse in Philippians when Paul, it's one of those memory verses that probably we all have to memorize as teenagers or something like this, right? Not to be anxious for anything, but in prayer and supplication, right? With thanksgiving. And I think about that because I think when I'm feeling anxious, something that helps me is to be reminded of how I've seen God to be faithful and trustworthy in the past, and think he's not, you know, he's not changing in that way, right? He'll continue to be trustworthy and faithful in the future, but I sometimes need to be reminded of how he has been in the past. And anyway, I say all that to say, this being reminded of who we are, our character, the good things that we've done, the strengths that we have, the ways that we've helped people are, you know, ways to think about going forward. Other, you know, again, not to say accountability isn't important, but to think about punishment, to think about the kind of violence that's used, to think about, you know, our prison systems where people are locked up and sometimes in solitary confinement and, you know, not able to see sunshine or interact with loved ones. You know, the people who know them best, the people who have cared for them. This can feel really immobilizing, to think about how can I possibly move forward? I'm stuck in the worst thing that I've ever done. You know, when I used to work in casework for the state, when I was, I think, probably too young to be doing that kind of work, but I did it right out of college. And one of the things that we were trained in is to have the mindset that we were joining with people who often had just possibly made the worst mistakes of their lives. And what does that look like to partner with someone and to be involved in that level of intimacy? Even as you alluded to before, you know, knowing that person, you know, you may know maybe the kind of the worst thing about them, you know, what does that look like to move forward? How can we do that with compassion? How can we do that with grace? How can we do that with wisdom and encouragement? And anyhow, just thinking about that tribe really, really hit me in how does God meet us when we have done irresponsible and foolish things? Does he meet us with wrath? Does he meet us with violence? Does he meet us, you know, or does he meet us with compassion? And, you know, and I think seeing that embodied in Jesus, And maybe that's what, you know, you talk about that or talk about anything else in relation to that, but just kind of thinking about Jesus' embodiment, I don't see the wrath of the penal substitution atonement theories in the life of Jesus and how he interacted with, quote, sinners.
Yeah, yeah. So we could think of the story of the prodigal son, which is a story of not only the son but the father and the older brother, right? And so I'm trying to get the story renamed to the story of the father, the older brother, the younger son. That's not going to happen. But that story, I rewrote it in my book, and is one where, if you notice, that the younger son comes back to his father and he says, "Forgive me, I'm a sinner. You know, take me back." And his father never called him a sinner. Okay, his father simply said, "No," and he's talking to the older brother. You know, your brother, he was once lost and now is found. He was once dead and is alive. Now I ask my students this: is being lost a bad thing? And they would say no. No, before we had the GPS, you know, on our phones, you know, driving around Houston, I get lost all the time, you know, but there is no condemnation in being lost, right? And so the perspective of the son was he was a sinner, but the perspective of the father was not. And that's amazing, because before Jesus tells the story of these three characters, he tells the story of the lost coin and the lost sheep, right? And what were the Pharisees and the scribes criticizing him for was eating and drinking with the sinners, right? So he was really telling these stories to them in a way, maybe those disciples who overheard. But that was Jesus's perspective. Yes, accountability, the scribes, the Pharisees, even the Sadducees and the Roman officials, they need accountability. They need to be confronted. But those who were broken by the system, those who were lost, those who were sick, they needed healing. They needed to see themselves as more than what society saw of them. They needed to see themselves as Jesus saw them, right? Jesus saw his disciples as being more than their labels, more than their what others thought about him, of them, more than what they thought about themselves, you know. Peter, okay, was Jesus's nickname for Simon, right? The rock, the, you know, Petros, you know, the rock. Someone stable, steadfast, reliable, in which Peter was not that person at all, you know. But Jesus always saw him differently. And the other day, I had a student who I was doing a discussion in my ethics class, and one of my students kept on doing some crosstalk with her friend. And I don't have much patience, Alexis. Okay, I don't know why I'm a school teacher. That's sort of, God has a sense of humor. But I told her, please, it's either me talking or you talking. Okay, we can't have both. And I could tell she recognized it. She said, "I'm sorry, you could talk." You know, she was hurt by it. And after class, I called her over outside. And I said, "I love you so much. You mean the world to me. Now, you're one of the best. Do you know that? And she said, yes. And she said, yeah, I'm sorry. And I said, I just want you to know that. And I think that's how we should be. You know, that's how our corrections should go, that we remind our young people, you know, who they really are, and our accountability to them is to make sure they know that. Know, if they don't, then they do go off and they do get lost. But the good news is we're here to steer them back, you know. And good news is, you know, God will always steer us back, right? Continuously, you know. And that's where I have problems with this idea, you know, God can not tolerate sin, cannot somehow it's a offense to God. Like that premise, you know, that God needs to pour out God's wrath on sin is patently mistaken, given the life of Jesus being with us, right? Emmanuel, not to justify the sinful acts that we do. That's not it, you know, but to help us see the things we are doing as wrong, and helping us to realize and correct that. And also giving us a way forward, because I think most of the time, you know, our young people and us, we choose to do the wrong things because we don't see the path forward, right? We think in this world there are no options, other options. And that's the damn thing about the violence as a solution, right? We only see one solution. So yeah, I think those are the real implications of this work. And if that was Christianity's message to the world, I think things would be a lot different.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you. That's a lot to think about. I love being able to, I love a good interview, a good recording. And in my mind, it is usually like I'm thinking how grateful I am just to be able to process this with the author, something like this. So I almost always come away with more questions than I brought into the conversation. And I think that's a good thing, to continually be questioning and thinking about these things. Because I think in short that what you touched on at the end has been true for probably most of us in our lives when we have made decisions. It's because we felt that maybe there was no other way. And I think that that's something that we kind of almost kind of laughing stereotypically see in Jesus, is that he almost always presents something that was completely off the wall, completely not what we thought were the options in certain scenarios. And so to follow Jesus sometimes means looking for options in place where we thought previously there were no options. It's so
That's
good.
good.
Thank you so much for being with me today. I want to encourage folks, again, this came out in 2020. This is not, though, a trendy text. This is a meaty one that we can come back to revisit. There's lots of history here. There's lots of Bible. There's lots of theology, and there's lots of ethics and justice, and I think hope in this text. And so I just want to encourage people to grab a copy. Again, it's Jesus of the East, Reclaiming the Gospel for the Wounded, by Fulu. Thank you, thank you, thank you for spending your time with me today.
Thank you so much, Alexis. It's been a pleasure. I could I say a few things about following me on the social
100%.
Media.
I would love it. Yes, then, please.
Yeah. So please follow me on Instagram if you get a chance. I'm on Facebook, but don't often comment. Instagram is where I comment. I'm not on Twitter, for personal reasons. And I have website fulu.com. I'm also a artist, and so you could see my work there. And for all your listeners, I am writing another manuscript called People of the Way. And so talking about how we as Christians, how the Christian religion, this movement could move forward and not back, and finding ways in which we could enter into conversation with culture and be transformative, restorative, and healing.
Amazing. Thank you so much. When is that due out? Is that going to be 25?
I'm not sure yet, but I'll let you know as soon as I know. So it's still in process.
Awesome. And I think the Instagram handle, is it right? Is it fulu_Houston?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Good. I'll put the website.
Definitely.
Thank you so much for mentioning that. I often forget. So I'll put the website with your art, the beautiful art, and the Instagram handle in the show notes for this episode, so that people can, find you and follow along and interact with you.
Awesome.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank
so,
you so much,
so much
for the conversation. It's been so life-giving.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Same here. I feel the same way. All right. Talk soon. The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.